It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania Secretary of Health Dr. Rachel Levine is asking colleges and universities to develop a strategy for testing students when they return to campus after the holidays. What are our universities doing before students leave campus for home? David Dalsey is Duquesne University's Executive Vice President and Provost, and he's an epidemiologist. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to be here.
We heard that 50 more students at the University of Pittsburgh's Oakland campus have tested positive for COVID-19 since last Friday, plus four more faculty or staff also infected. How's the situation on Duquesne's campus? How many students, staff, have tested positive since the start of the semester?
Since the start of the semester, we've had just shy of 300 total cases. We've monitored it on a regular basis through our student health service.
Nearing the Thanksgiving break, are you still having some classes in person?
We are finishing up this week. There are a lot of students that will be, you know, sort of leaving this week. And we do have a few days next week. And then everyone is gone until January 21st, 2021.
So it is not only a Thanksgiving break, it is a full break for the Christmas holidays as well, is what you're saying.
Yes, we suspected what we're witnessing right now as a country. And so our team prepared to start on time and end early. So we were able to start as, you know, cases were kind of hitting a lull, and to end as, you know, cases around the country are starting to pick up. That was part of our original plan. It worked, and we're glad it did. But, you know, we of course had to take, in some regards, an educated guess in terms of what we thought was going to happen with the trends of the disease.
Did the students get enough in this compressed time frame than they normally would have?
Well, they did. So the way that we did it, which is different than some other universities, we basically had it so that they had their full semester before Thanksgiving. And then after this, they'll be taking exams. So the students aren't completely done at Duquesne.
Universities are like small communities within a larger one, in this case, Pittsburgh. There is significant resurgence in the city, in Allegheny County. Do you think there is any way you can keep cases lower at your school when students are back on campus?
We're going to be studying the trends over the break and also looking at technologies. And so, for example, new technologies for testing cases come up every day. And so there could be, come the new year, new technology that are available to help us rapidly test and understand. So at this point, you know, there are significant challenges to do so, especially as you see spikes in cases around the country. That's one of the reasons why we decided to push our semester back.
Duquesne is encouraging all students returning home for the holidays to get tested. You started this past Monday. How's it gone so far?
Really well. I mean, I think students and parents have been very grateful. We wanted parents and students to have some measure of confidence with the students returning. We decided to sort of use a test kit that allows them to either test before they leave if parents are picking them up so they can get their result before their parents pick them up, or after they return. Let's just say they're driving themselves home and they can self-quarantine for 1 or 2 days at home. They can take the test after they get home and self-quarantine for 2 days and then have their result following.
You mentioned earlier about 268 cases so far. How has compliance been campus-wide about wearing face masks and keeping social distancing? These are young people, after all.
It has been remarkably good, and I don't want to be Pollyannish about it. We have had our incidences, parties where there have been violations and other things, so it has not been perfect. But I will tell you that on the whole, I've been incredibly proud of the student population at Duquesne.
Can you punish for not doing so? What are the repercussions?
That's one of the things we're actually going to be discussing over the break. So we did have carrots and sticks this semester for students that engaged in behavior that was against our protocols. The biggest was that, you know, we could certainly tell students that they were no longer allowed to take classes on campus or be on campus and would have to go home and take classes remotely. So that is obviously a form of punishment if you're not following the rules. But the question is whether or not there are additional carrots and sticks to both incentivize the behaviors that you want, but also to disincentivize those that you don't.
Right. A few weeks ago, You suspended Greek life on campus for violating COVID orders. What's the plan moving forward for the fraternities and sororities?
So we're going to reconvene in February to review and discuss with the fraternities and sororities. But the biggest thing we want to emphasize is, you know, we're all responsible to each other, and that includes our students in Greek life. You know, there were violations that were clearly against the Protect Duquesne pledge, and so we had to take an action that was designed to protect the Duquesne community first.
Mm-hmm. To put things into context, how do schools, universities, and outbreaks there fit into the spike of COVID-19 cases that we're seeing countywide, statewide?
I think it's just part of rather than, you know, responsible for. So there were a lot of concerns when college and university students came back that they would be the source of outbreaks in local areas, and that they would be driving those outbreaks. And at least in the Pittsburgh region, we don't have evidence to suggest that, because oftentimes students are isolated on campus or primarily on campus. What we've seen is you see spikes in the university community that don't necessarily translate to the broader Pittsburgh community.
So you've been testing students before they leave. What about procedures when they return to campus after the holidays? Will you test them before they step foot on campus, or as they're stepping foot on campus in January?
So we haven't made that decision yet, because there are a variety of different ways in which we might be able to do that testing, including having students test themselves before they come back. What we are definitely doing so far in terms of our planning is we have delayed the start of the semester by 2 weeks. And so we are asking students and faculty between January 7th and January 21st to self-quarantine at home, to basically try to stay with their nuclear families, so that during that time they will monitor signs and symptoms. We did that at the start of the fall semester, and it was a surprisingly good way for us to identify potential cases. Whether or not we add additional testing is still something that is going to depend on what tests are available at the time, and how accurate they are, and how rapidly we can get the results.
David Dowsey is Duquesne University's Executive Vice President, Provost, and he's an epidemiologist. David, thanks so much for your time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mail-in ballots are not just the focal point of legal challenges in the presidential contest in Pennsylvania, but also in a hotly contested state Senate race in Allegheny County between 10-year Democratic incumbent Jim Brewster and Republican challenger Nicole Zuccarelli. WESA's Lucy Perkins reports on politics and government accountability, and she's been covering this race and the court case. So, Lucy, just how close is this election between Brewster and Zuccarelli?
It is the closest state Senate race that we've seen this fall. There are only 30 votes separating Brewster from Zuccarelli right now. Brewster has that very, very slim lead, but that's why these lawsuits came up.
Has everything been counted, including provisionals, or not?
Well, these lawsuits held up ballots from being counted. So no, not everything has been counted yet.
So Common Pleas Judge Joseph James ruled in favor of the Board of Elections' decision to count the mail-in ballots. What was his reasoning?
Right. In the Wednesday ruling by Judge James, he wrote that in light of the fact that there was no fraud with these 2,349 mail-in ballots, that they were in question from a mere technical omission, that they should be counted. And the issue with these ballots was that on the back of the declaration envelope, where voters must write their name, put down their address, and sign and date it, these ballots, the voter had done everything correctly, except they forgot to write down the date. That was not an issue, according to Judge James, because, first of all, he ruled that it was just a technical omission. And in addition to that, the county timestamps every mail-in ballot it receives when it receives it. And all of these ballots were received by Election Day.
And that was the gist of the argument of the Zuccarelli campaign, that it was not dated, the outer envelope?
Correct. Pennsylvania Election Code does state that voters must sign and date the back of the mail-in envelope.
And so the judge said that was just a technical issue, or what?
Yes, the judge said it was a technical issue. He pointed to other lawsuits that have been in regards to the color of ink that the voter used to fill out the ballot. In election code, it says that the voter must use blue or black ink. But other cases have said if a voter doesn't use blue or black ink necessarily, but a different color pen, that's a technical error, and it is not grounds for that ballot to be dismissed.
So was this used as precedence, the color of ink, for Judge James to rely on, or did he cite something else?
Well, that technicality over the color of a pen was talked about in this case. But the judge also pointed to state election law, which says that the goal of election law has to be to favor the enfranchisement of voters and not the disenfranchisement. He wrote in his ruling on Wednesday that, you know, the goal must be to be flexible in order to favor the right to vote.
Lucy, the mail-in ballots was actually one suit. The Ziccarelli campaign also filed suit regarding provisional ballots.
That's right. This second case had to do with about 300 provisional ballots. And I'll remind listeners, provisional ballots are used on election day at the polls when a voter encounters a problem, either with voting in person, they think that they should be able to vote at that polling place and, you know, they're not in the poll books, or they requested a mail-in ballot and they never received one. You can, you know, go to your polling place on election day and vote provisionally. These 300 provisional ballots were missing a signature. Your voters are required to sign their provisional ballots in two different places. And these ballots, the voter had signed one line but had forgotten to sign the other line. And Judge James sided with the Allegheny County Board of Elections view again in this case, saying that voters shouldn't be penalized for errors or problems with a ballot that are not their fault. You know, if an election worker or a poll worker instructed them to fill it out and the voter didn't do it quite right, the voter should not be penalized. And he also noted that there was no fraud alleged in this case. And of course, there wasn't any fraud alleged in the other case either.
And Lucy, the chance for appeal?
Yes. So I spoke with a lawyer for Nicole Ziccarelli on Wednesday, and he said that they will be appealing the decisions.
WESA reporter Lucy Perkins covers politics and government accountability. Thanks so much, Lucy.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The iconic American chestnut largely disappeared from eastern forests after a blight took down some 4 billion of these giants a century ago. Now researchers are moving forward with a genetically engineered tree that allows chestnuts to survive the blight. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has the story.
Mike Auchett has been spending a lot of time in the woods this fall.
Here I am in the Allegheny National Forest.
The retired scientist walks over the rocky soil. It's covered with lowbush blueberries.
And this is the kind of place where you tend to find remnant surviving Americans.
American chestnuts were once common here. They were some of the largest, fastest growing trees. The wood was rot resistant and used in everything from cradles to coffins. When American chestnuts succumbed to the blight, at least 5 species of insect went extinct. American chestnuts still grow in the forest. Alcott finds one that produced nuts 2 years ago, but the top of the tree now looks dead.
That shows that the blight is getting into it.
The blight is a fungus that was brought to the U.S. when chestnut trees were first imported from China and Japan. The fungus produces an acid in the tree, and while Asian varieties are adapted to fight it off, the acid creates a lethal canker on American chestnuts. The roots continue to sprout and start to grow.
And as it grows, it will get the blight again and get killed down again. Eventually, the roots run out of energy and the whole tree dies.
William Powell has been working to restore the American chestnut at the State University of New York in Syracuse for over 30 years. And he says people have been trying for much longer than that to make a hybrid chestnut that's resistant to the blight.
I've seen papers all the way back to the 1920s, hybridizing it with the Japanese chestnut, the Chinese chestnut, you know, all kinds of different things, trying to make blight-resistant trees. None of them have been successful getting it back out into the wild.
So Powell and his colleagues turned to genetic engineering. They figured out that a gene in the wheat plant enhances resistance to the fungus that causes the blight. So they've added that gene to the cells of the American chestnut.
And this gene makes an enzyme that actually detoxifies the acid that the fungus throws at the plant. And by giving the tree the ability to make this enzyme, you basically take away or neutralize the weapon of the fungus. And therefore, the fungus and the tree can coexist.
Powell and his team have successfully grown test plots of genetically engineered American chestnuts in New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Currently, these GMO trees are federally regulated and are required to be cut before they flower. Powell has petitioned the USDA to deregulate the trees so they can mature and reproduce. He says so far, the process has taken 5 years.
It's just so reckless.
This is Ann Peterman, director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, which has developed a coalition of hundreds of groups worldwide opposed to genetically engineered trees. Other GMO trees have been developed for commercial production to survive frost or insect pests. Peterman says the GMO American chestnut is designed not for farms, but to spread through forests. She worries this could have unintended consequences for the ecosystem.
It would be the first GMO plant in the world to be released with the intention of spreading in the wild. What will be the impact on the future generations of these genetically engineered trees? Again, no one knows.
Peterman worries the GMO chestnut could be a Trojan horse, the first GMO tree approved in the U.S.
And that precedent, of course, then makes it a lot easier to get other genetically engineered trees approved.
Sarah Fitzsimmons disagrees.
People saying this is a rubber stamp for other species, it's not.
She's director of restoration for the American Chestnut Foundation and is a research technologist at Penn State.
You know, the USDA takes 2 or more years for every application to carefully consider all the consequences of a decision that it makes.
The foundation plants hybrids throughout the eastern U.S., but Fitzsimmons says it's not been enough to restore the trees. So they support the genetically engineered, also called transgenic, American chestnut.
I am not of the opinion that transgenic American chestnuts are going to save and restore the species on its own. It needs to be coupled with other techniques, but it is an incredibly important tool, you know, not just for American chestnut, but for other native species.
Back at the Allegheny National Forest, Mike Auchett wishes people could just allow nature to take its own course. But he fears that's no longer possible.
Things are going to get worse. They're not going to get better if we just let nature take its course. I think the days of doing that, unfortunately, are over.
The proposal to deregulate the genetically engineered American chestnut will need approval from USDA as well as other federal agencies. I'm Julie Grant.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Laura Satsui, Joya Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.